From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour was made on September 21st, 2017 in Washington, D.C. A Blue Ribbon panel met to discuss how to deal with climate change. But this wasn't a congressional Blue Ribbon panel or a group of activists. It was a group of just 11 people chosen by the American Society of Landscape Architects. What does landscape design and architecture have to do with climate change and with environmental sustainability? We're about to find out. One of those 11 members is Mark Dawson, managing principal and landscape architect with a firm called Sasaki Associates. Dawson is in Rochester as a featured speaker of the Reshaping Rochester series hosted by the Community Design Center. His presentation will look at the evolution of civic parks and open space design. So this hour, we sit down with him to find out about what he wants to bring to the Rochester audience and about what the Blue Ribbon panel discussed regarding climate change. Mark Dawson, welcome to Connections.
Thank you.
Also joining me in studio is Bill Price, a landscaped architect and urban planner with SWBR and vice president for the board of directors at the Community Design Center. Welcome to you, Bill.
Thank you.
So let's start with what's happening tonight, Bill. Tell our listeners what they can expect at Reshaping Rochester.
Mark has been asked to join us and give us his opinions on the evolution of parks and open space in, you know, the broader context. Mark's work expands around the world, and we would like to have, you know, his opinions and his experience brought to Rochester to tell us a little bit about what he sees going on globally and nationally and how it applies to us here in Rochester.
That presentation is called Exploring the Spaces in Between, and it begins at 7 o'clock tonight at Gleason Works Auditorium. That's at 1000 University Avenue. And Bill, this year the events are all free.
Yeah, we have been very fortunate to have an underwriting sponsor, Home Leasing, that is making it possible that everybody can enjoy this.
Great. So make sure you register, sign up, get there early, because Bill mentioned to me before the hour began that these are packed houses.
Yeah, this year we've really enjoyed a full house, standing room only at our previous lectures so far.
And where can people find more information?
At our website, cdcr.com. And tonight, you know, you come into Gleason Works and we have a booth set up right there at the entrance.
Great. And we'll be sure to post the link to that website on our podcast page for this episode, listeners, so you can check there. And if you'd like to join this conversation, you can call 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can email the program at connections@wxxi.org. And you can find me on Twitter at mmacmedia. Seeing your feedback already starting to come in. And that's pretty normal when we talk about urban planning. So we'll be hearing from our listeners this hour. Mark, I'd like to start with you and the concept of cities as a living ecosystem. You've written about that. You've spoken about that. What exactly does that mean?
Well, I think it's a system. I think like nature, it's based on systems of habitat, biology, weather, and you know, urban centers are that. And ideally, the diversity of population and the access to services and health and wellness issues are important. So I think it is the ecosystem in my mind, and it's also only continuing to grow as we're seeing more and more movement towards urban living on the planet. It's really changing what our cities are now being asked to do, which they didn't have to do 100 years ago.
That's something you mentioned before the hour began, Bill, talking about populations moving back into city centers. What do you see happening here in Rochester?
Well, I think it's very similar to what's happening nationally, where whether it's the millennial generation and the boomer generations that are really leading this, where we're moving back into not only our cities, but also our towns and villages. And we're, you know, some of the new development is to create the kind of environments like we see in villages historically, you know, being created in town centers.
As we talk about that, and as we talk about urban design and its relation to climate change, these are conversations that seem relatively new to some people, the relationship between climate change and urban design. And as I mentioned earlier, Mark, you were selected to serve on the American Society of Landscape Architects Blue Ribbon panel last year, exploring climate change and resilience in architecture. And you were just one of 11 people across the entire country. What does it mean to be selected for that kind of group?
Well, it's an honor. I mean, it's a reflection of our practice at Sasaki and things we're interested in, and we've been active for many years. It's not a new thing for us, where we've always been designing with systems, and I mean system design, whether it's nature, climate, sea level rise. It's happening, and we're not denying that, and so we have to find strategies to respond to the changing climate that we're all facing.
Do you find that Sasaki is an outlier in that? Do you find that most architects aren't having conversations about climate change?
Oh, I think in the last 10 years, particularly in the last five since Sandy rolled through New York City, that we're all talking about it, architects and landscape architects and urban designers, and it's in everybody's conversation today.
I would agree that, our firm, we have a director of sustainability, and we've reached over 1 million square feet of LEED certified projects at this point. There is really no project, whether it includes a building component or it's really just a transportation or open space project, that does not include sustainability, resilience, in the programming and the design.
Is this panel a new concept, Mark? Because it seems as if it were put together as a reaction to Hurricanes Harvey and Irma. Or was that planned before any kind of natural disaster happened?
It was planned before that. I mean, the panel was put in place really to try to affect policy. ASLA represents more the policy body of the practice of landscape architecture. So what we were trying to do is help inform policy. That was the ultimate outcome of that panel.
And I know those recommendations are not published yet.
That's
they should
correct.
Be out this spring, so you may not be able to break any news. But what are some of the conversations that you had in terms of tangible ideas?
Well, first, that we have to all accept that there is climate change, and that's a process. But the reality is it starts with nature. And when you look at nature and its durability or its vulnerability, and it has both, there's many lessons that can be learned from that. And there's got to be respect for nature. You know, I grew up on the coast and on the water, and, you know, I've experienced out on the water weather conditions that when you leave, it's blue sky, and then when you turn around 2 hours later, it's green skies, and the water churns, and the world really changes. So I think we're seeing more extreme weather conditions now. So what can we do as city builders? What can we do when we do accept the fact that sea level is in fact rising for those communities on the coast? What can we start to do and plan today that will affect and help protect investment in citizens moving forward 50 years from now?
Were you focusing on certain areas of the country, or were you looking at the country as a whole?
I mean, it's really a country as a whole, because it's not all coastal based. It's the Mississippi River, the Mississippi River Delta. It's the Ohio River. You name it. The Missouri River. They all are going through real tests of engineering that's probably 50 to 80 years old that was never designed to manage or harness the conditions we're facing now. So, what's the solution? Is it more engineering solutions? In some cases, I think it is. I think in a lot of cases, it's not. It's smarter planning. It's taking a longer view of what's really happening and responding to that, designing with nature.
Bill, what do you think about that? I know your expertise is in riverfront design, and you've done a lot of work here in Rochester at High Falls. But as you look at the climate across the country, are you seeing any parallels to what's happening in our community?
Sure. I would say the Genesee River is a little bit immune to some of the major climatic events. Letchworth has the dam that's been there now, you know, for 50 plus years. And, you know, we see the remaining flood control walls, you know, along our river here. And we do have the falls and several dams which control it. So we don't see the kind of impacts that some of the other communities do. But in New York, Hudson River, the Mohawk River, some of these other major water bodies are susceptible to significant flooding. And, you know, we notice in those communities, you know, up and down the Hudson River, really have to pay attention to the floodplain and what it means to, you know, our social activities and economic development along the shoreline.
What do you think about Plan 2020 as we look at some of the damage along the lakefront up in the Shalott area? You're smiling. We won't make it a political conversation about Plan 2014, but does any of your work overlap with that? Or are you looking at the lake as well?
Well, I would say that the, you know, that does get into some issues of how the lake levels are controlled. But lake levels are, you know, the reason for controlling the lake levels are these, you know, environmental issues. So I think, you know, we're trying to kind of come up with some short-term solutions for, you know, these events, you know, to solve some of the initial flooding issues. But I think it needs to take a step back also and look at, you know, where are we going to go with this in the future? Is it going to be armoring the entire shoreline, or are we going to start to reduce the amount of development along the shoreline and start to, you know, bring that back to more of a natural environment?
What do you think is likely to happen, or what would your recommendations be?
I think in the short term, you know, there's going to ultimately be those short-term solutions to protect properties and property owners' investments. But then also looking long term, you know, what can be done from an environmental design standpoint and an engineering standpoint to try and mitigate what we're going to continue to see happen, you know, year after year now.
Mark, what do you think? I don't know if you're familiar with what's happening up on our lakefront north of here.
Not in great detail, but just in terms of coastal erosion, those are important things that if not addressed through either better sort of ecological strategies for armament or engineered strategies, they do need to happen. And so my preference would be for more ecological strategies, but, you know, there's economic development issues in ports and harbors that are really important, and those, that strategy is a different response in an urbanized waterfront.
What's an example of an ecological strategy that you would recommend in a case like that? Either one of you.
Well, I think part of that's, again, it's about working with plants, soils, and materials that can actually shore up the stability of the shoreline itself, and then contribute to habitat, meaning birds and vertebrates and improve basic habitat of the coastlines.
And I think with examples like Superstorm Sandy in New York, and also with Katrina in New Orleans, we've seen, you know, post those events, the attempt to reclaim some of the wetland areas and the low areas for water storage capacity, as well as to reduce the velocity of the water and the impacts that causes. So, you know, again, in the short term here, to solve some of the issues that property owners are facing, you know, you have armoring solutions, but where there is the ability to do a more natural shoreline that not only provides for flood storage capacity, reduces velocity of water, or the impact of wave, attenuates the waves, but also provides habitat, is really, you know, we need to look for those opportunities to solve this.
Considering some of the short-term and long-term effects of the flooding, if someone were to come up to you tonight at the event and say, I'm looking at property on the lake, I know what's going on up there, would you discourage them from purchasing property on the lakefront?
I wouldn't discourage it, but I would say let's look at the science behind your property and understand what are the physical constraints or opportunities depending on its elevation in relationship to the water, and in looking at prevailing winds, its erosion, and you can really investigate site conditions that would inform design decisions. Now, you'd ideally probably like to do that in advance of somebody acquiring property, because it could be an issue where they might not want to acquire, but it's a case by case.
Yeah, anything that can be done to just educate them as to what the potential impacts are going to be, and let them know what the potential solutions are. That helps inform their decision.
I want to talk about solutions that we can come up with that are solutions to problems we've created. And what I mean by that is looking at what's going on in Louisiana. And Mark, I know you were part of a big project there. And if I'm to paraphrase, it was a system of faucets. And I was reading an article this morning, 10 Designs Fighting the Devastating Effects of Climate Change. And I'll just quote from that now. It says, quote, Louisiana is drowning. Over the last 8 decades, more than 2,000 square miles of land have disappeared underwater. This is partially due to an ill-thought-out plan in the 1930s by local engineers to seal off the Mississippi River with levees to prevent flooding that also inadvertently stymied the river's natural process of building land. This process included the slow accumulation of sediment in the delta, which traditionally helped protect cities from storms and flooding. And then it talked about a new project that your firm has been working on, and that has to do with a system of faucets. Tell us about that, Mark.
Well, I think, you know, rivers have their natural rhythms in course, right? And so they actually are affected by stormwater, rainfall, drought. They go up and down, and they are quite a naturalized system. The minute we try to tame something like the Mississippi is a risky moment in time. I've had conversations with friends in New Orleans. New Orleans is below sea level, so truthfully, the city should never have been built there. If you had vision 120 years ago, New Orleans probably wouldn't have been built there. But here we have just a tremendous infrastructure, a great city, strong culture. The reality is that how do we protect it, or how do we provide smart management of storm events for New Orleans? And one of the biggest issues there were the underserved, the poor were the ones who could not retreat in the storm. And that was repaired by the mayor, his name escapes me, but the previous mayor, or the former mayor, there was another hurricane that went over New Orleans, and the first thing they did was make sure that people could evacuate to safe grounds. Now, there's a whole challenge of economics for those people who may not be able to afford hoteling or whatever for extended times, but there was a solution there. So the question is, how prepared are you for an event like that? Because New Orleans isn't going away, and we can't build the wall higher, and it's not going to stop it. But there are ways to manage also the confluence of the Mississippi Delta and the Gulf Coast in the ways that you can find productive sediment and you can redirect river channels in these faucets so that they don't do the scouring or the depositing that's detrimental to New Orleans and its flood protection.
How is that controlled? Who makes the decisions about when the faucets are turned on or off? And what does that look like? Does it actually look like a faucet?
No, it's not a faucet. It's a big, sophisticated flood protection, flood wall, flood gate condition, which is generally done by the Corps of Engineers, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
Mm-hmm. Bill, did you want to jump in there?
No, here in Rochester, this is just not something that we're even used to, and
right.
You know, we don't talk about flooding in that anywhere near that same capacity.
How far along is that project? Is it currently in use?
No, not at all. It's still in the preliminary engineering phase right now. It's a huge project and has significant financial implications. So it's still in the preliminary engineering phases.
Do you see it moving forward?
Slowly.
What's the timeline, do you think?
I bet it's 10 to 15 years before it be realized. Yeah.
Looking at sort of the economic impact that it might have, how much do you think it could save in recovery efforts if there were more damage? What could it keep us?
I couldn't put a dollar figure to that. I don't know where to begin.
Do you think political leaders are open-minded enough about urban design when it comes to trying to prevent damage from climate change?
I think they're getting there. I wouldn't say they're open enough yet. I think there's a gap. I think there's, well, clearly there's a gap at the highest levels of our federal government. So I think there's a gap.
I would say that the issues around sustainability are becoming mainstream now. We've got several years now where, you know, the LEED and ASLA's sites criteria have morphed into New York State Power Authority's Cleaner, Greener Climate Initiative, as well as New York State DEC's Climate Smart Communities Initiatives. So I think we're seeing, the sustainability issues becoming mainstream, right down to, subdivision and site plan approval for projects. The issues of resiliency are probably a little bit further out. People are starting to understand the word, but I think we've got a ways to go on resiliency issues.
Mm-hmm. When each of you are working with clients, are they coming to you because they know that you're concerned about climate change and you're trying to find solutions in urban design that are related to that? Or do you find that you have to convince most people to consider green alternatives?
I would say locally, again, that not only the planning community, and by planning community, I mean the municipal planners, the town supervisors are embracing it. It's working its way into codes now. And I believe that most of the developers now understand, finally, we're beyond rain gardens and bioretention filters. We're really into sustainability as far as reducing, the parking demands and getting much deeper into it. So I don't know that they're specifically coming to any consultant saying, let's, because you do sustainability. I think it's now mainstream and people are embracing it.
I would say they do come to us for that expertise. And, it's been built upon by sheer fortune in some respects. We were doing work in Cedar Rapids when the Cedar River flooded, and we were doing a riverfront master plan. And we were in a meeting with the city manager, and a staff person came in, whispered in his ear, and he said, we'll have to suspend the meeting because there's flooding upriver. And the Cedar River, which we were on Mays Island, which is in the middle, bridged in the middle, was under real threat of flooding. And in fact, the city had a terrible flood event. And that's where we started. We were there the night of that flood event and then stayed and went through a four-year process of trying to rebuild the community and help with understanding flood protection and then how to respond to that. So hence we do have sort of a expertise, but a lot of firms are contributing to that building of knowledge and expertise.
I'd like to go through some of your individual projects because I think the Rochester community can learn from the work that you're doing across the country. And that plays into conversations that we've had on this program about Parcel 5, about Rock the Riverway. I'm using key phrases here that I know will generate listener interest. I know those of you listening do have a lot of questions and concerns and ideas about those projects. And now's your chance to weigh in on that conversation, to ask Mark Dawson and Bill Price your questions about urban design. What will work for our community? You can call the program at 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263 WXXI 263-9994. We'll take our short break, and when we come back, more conversations about urban planning, specifically civic parks, and what might look good here in Rochester. More connections next. Coming up in our second hour, how can the arts help us understand the human stories behind political issues? A new play at Jiva Theater takes that question head on. We'll talk about the production called Heartland, and some other examples of how the arts can be used to broaden our perspectives and our understanding of our world. That's coming up on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Megan Mack, sitting in for Evan Dawson. Today, we are talking with Mark Dawson, the managing principal and landscape architect with a firm called Sasaki Associates. Thanks for joining us today, Mark.
Thank you.
Also in studio, Bill Price, a landscape architect and urban planner with SWBR, and he's also the vice president for the board of directors at the Community Design Center of Rochester. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
Bill, remind us again what's coming up tonight.
Tonight, Mark is going to be speaking at our Reshaping Rochester lecture series. He's been invited for his both his own personal work, but the work of the firm, which is internationally known and certainly known within the landscape architecture community for sure. But they are just doing incredible work around the world, and we'd like to have Mark's insights on how public spaces have come to be and where we think they're going.
Great. So listeners, you can learn more at their website, which is?
RRCDC.com. I think
.org.
I said something. .org. I'm sorry.
I have a cheat sheet.
I said that wrong earlier.
That's okay. RRCDC.org/reshapingRochester is what you want to check out. Mm-hmm. And we'll be spending some time this hour talking about civic parks. And that's a concept that we've been talking a lot about this program. And that's because we're hearing about plans for Parcel 5. We're talking about Rock the Riverway, city projects coming up, potential projects, I should say. And I know that people in this community have very strong ideas. They'd like to see more green space, many of them. And Mark, I know that's something that you specialize in. What are some good examples of green spaces that are used effectively across the country? And I should also say, not all green spaces are effective in the way that people think they will be. So we'll talk about the difference between effective green spaces and green spaces.
Yeah. Central Park, New York City, a pretty effective green space. I think you can look at Rochester has some great parks and public space. You can look at river cities like Chicago, and Chicago is an interesting river city in that it's sort of controlled, a controlled river. But what they've done to kind of reconnect to rivers, and we're seeing all over the country, any city that has water generally wants to try to take advantage of that and use that as an opportunity to leverage potential development, future development, public open space.
What makes a green space effective, though?
Well, I think that's a good question. Take Bryant Park. Bryant Park in New York City, one of the most highly programmed parks in the nation. But what makes green space successful is really what it does and how it affects a person. So there's evidence, documentation, research done on green space, and people, when people enjoy and can find green space, blood pressure goes down, breathing improves, and there's a absolute impact on the physical. And so Bryant Park, half a city block, New York City, 4 million people in its surround and walking distance. It has 5,000 people visit there at lunchtime a day. If you take it sort of a two hour window, that's a tremendous asset to the economic development of the city. There's great examples all over the country of good green spaces, good open space. I think there's some cities like Greenville, South Carolina, which I know the city has sort of benchmarked, Rochester has benchmarked. The Reedy River they discovered and were able to provide access, and it moved development to the south of the river that never happened. And that's been a process that's been in place, a planning process that's been ongoing for over 30 years. But today it's a mature city, and it's a great model to look at. So I think, you know, how do you get to good green spaces about process, and how do you identify strategically where they need to be or where those resources are, and how do you connect community to them? And they're generally free. That's the best part, right? They're for the public. And that to me is one of the reasons why I'm so passionate about open space.
Would you ever discourage a community from pursuing a green space? Are there reasons to say maybe this is not the right fit here that you've seen maybe trending, or you've seen examples of it was a great idea, it just didn't pan out, and you've seen that pattern repeated?
I haven't I've never seen a sort of stop sign when people were trying to do open space. It's really about what are the community's priorities and in balancing that. And I think because there's such a stratification from the most wealthiest to the poorest, that most of this public open space is for the public. And I think that is a critical factor in terms of the success of it. So I've never really seen poor open space. I've seen open space poorly maintained, but that relates to city budgets and capabilities. That's usually when it goes bad, is when it just is, they turn their backs and stop taking care of it.
So it seems like community investment is really what's needed here. You need to have the support of the community in order to make this happen. Bill, do you see that happening here?
I would say between Rock the River and the issues that are going on with Parcel 5, part of the part with parks is the whole socializing aspect of it. And I think, you know, Parcel 5, you know, through some of the East End Fest, the Jazz Fest, Fashion Week, you know, other things that are programmed in downtown, Parcel 5 has kind of jumped out and established itself as a valuable public open space. We have other public open spaces along the river that are, you know, less programmed, that if they were to be programmed a little bit more, we might see more activity along them. Or if there was more private investment and things going on at either end of the park, you might see more people starting to come down.
Let's focus a little bit on what's going on with Parcel 5 right now. And I know, Mark, you're not from this community. You may not know the specifics, but I think some of the broader concepts might be something that you can help us understand. The current proposal is to build an entertainment complex there with a performing arts center, an IMAX theater, green space on the rooftop, and apartments with outdoor seating and room for concerts. So last week, Rochester City Council approved a site survey and money for a consultant to take a look at that. But those in the community who are critical of that proposal say they'd like to see more of a community dialogue about how the space will be used, which refers to what you were saying earlier, Mark. But they've also brought up the concept of Columbus Commons as an example of what they'd like to see at Parcel 5. And listeners, if you're not familiar, Columbus Commons was presented as a mixed-use development space filled with privately developed residential, retail, and commercial space, but it's all anchored in green space. So when you look at it on the whole, it looks very green, and it's surrounded by these other types of spaces. And online it says since opening in 2011, it's been a place where people can gather, establish a sense of community, and then it's enhanced by residential and retail options. And I heard from a listener named Erin who lives in Columbus, and she said she loves Columbus Commons. She spends a lot of time there, especially in the summer when there are concerts. She thinks it's a great outdoor space. But her concern about it is that she doesn't see enough people there in the winter. And she says there's not that much activity except for at night when there's a Christmas lights display. So I guess my question for here, considering we're in Rochester, New York, and the weather is unpredictable, and our winter lasts 11 months long, of course, that's a joke. But what do you think, Mark, if we're developing or trying to develop green spaces, Parcel 5 or otherwise, whatever happens with that space, and we're faced with the concern of winter, how can we use the space most effectively in other seasons that are not summer?
Mm-hmm. You know, seasonal use of space is something we design for. So you're in a climate that has ice, you would probably introduce ice, and then you program it. And you know, there's food venues. It's done successfully in Minneapolis and in Toronto, and there are cities in the northern climes that actually are quite active outdoors. And
Buffalo,
yeah. So I think that's an important design aspect, the design for seasons, and Rochester would certainly qualify for that. You know, I haven't been in Rochester very long, but I've heard a lot about Parcel 5, and my only observation would be there should be a process for which there is dialogue around Parcel 5. It seems curious to me that there isn't more of a dialogue, a public dialogue about it, because I find that although those conversations can be exhausting, you learn a lot. And as designers, that's what we want. We need that input. We need that dialogue. And I think it's important, and process is important. A truncated result is going to meet with opposition, I have to imagine, because there's not, dialogue matters.
There isn't anyone from the city of Rochester here on the panel, so I will say what they would probably say if they were here, that there are public workshops and public meetings where the community members are invited to attend and speak up, and I think some of those meetings have seen more than 100 people. But Mark and Bill as well, in your perspective, does this top-down approach work for designers, or would you rather see it starting from the ground up with the community and then working your way up to developers?
I think the top needs to empower the base to go out and do this. So with a planning department and a planning director, that's often who are our immediate consultant, our clients. And there is a process, and it's equitable, it's accessible, and it's frequent. And I think that's where we've seen success in public design, where you have some very difficult challenge conversations, but at the end of the day, it does make for a better outcome. And then the community feels as if they own it. And that's what we hope for any community we work in. It's not Mark Dawson's space or Sasaki, it's the communities. And when the ownership happens, then they start watching out for it and self-policing to some extent. And it's amazing what can happen.
Yeah, I agree with Mark, but I do think that I'm not sure that the city's showing us necessarily a top-down approach to this necessarily, but it probably can feel like it. But I think they do embrace, you know, kind of a public process for engagement and education, and I think it should continue with this current proposal that's on the table. You know, we want to make sure that, you know, all age groups and socioeconomic groups are heard in this discussion, and it doesn't get overwhelmed by one constituency. So I think, you know, what Mark has said and what's some of the examples in Columbus is these spaces can be very successful. They can't entirely be privatized and turned over to just the private sector for economic benefit. But they're going to be most successful if it has both an economic development component and a public purpose.
I'd just like to take an opportunity to clarify some information that came out from the city of Rochester last week, because we've been hearing, WXXI News has been hearing from people in our community who are a little confused about an email or a press release that went out. And I think the way that it was written, people interpreted it that the proposal did go through for Parcel 5. That's not what that press release was saying. They're saying that City Council voted to approve a site survey and a consultant to look at the project. So the project itself has not been approved. They voted to continue the conversation about it. So just to clarify that for some listeners who are confused, and I'm seeing the phone starting to ring. Listeners, you can join the conversation, 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Up first on the phones is Jeff in Penfield. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, I was one of the leaders of a Save Shadow Pine citizens group in Penfield. And the issue that we ran into was that there was golf as a sport is declining in the country. And there were some golf courses that had been put up for sale in the area, one in particular in our town. And a citizens group, we decided to try to preserve this as open space and help encourage our local government to have preserve this area. We had a referendum, and 80% of the people voted in favor of preserving it for open space, so it was very positive. But I was hoping you might be able to talk about, one, the trend of the declining sport of golf and how that land is opening up in a lot of areas in the country, and then also about the benefits of green space in suburbs in general.
Thanks, Jeff. I'll put you on hold one moment. Go ahead, Bill. Shadow Pines.
Well, I've had experience in developing one golf course in my life, and I would say that when you talk about golf course communities in general, yes, you're seeing a decline. There's a decline in playing and revenues overall. So I wasn't aware. I was been certainly watching, you know, the what's going on in Penfield with Shadow Pines. I was never aware that that was it was considered to become a golf course again. I thought the argument came down to residential development or mixed use development versus green space, and it appears that, you know, the town has looked to, you know, save this as public green space, which would then need to be programmed into their overall park master plan and see, you know, exactly what needs to be done with this.
Mm-hmm. Jeff, I'll let you jump back in. Any follow-up questions for Bill about that, or questions for Mike regarding the project?
No, we weren't suggesting to maintain it as a golf course. We were the citizens group was concerned about having it maintained as open space as it appears that it will continue. But one of the arguments that came up there that was very interesting that we came across with this is that property taxes for residential development often do not pay for the educational costs that are involved. And that is, again, one of the benefits of open space, and I imagine you run into that in other areas as well.
That part is pretty well established, that the taxes generated from residential development don't even cover the cost of the school costs associated with it. So I think that most municipalities do look for that balance, you know, either leave it in green space or look for a balance of commercial, retail, institutional, industrial type uses to balance and kind of keep the tax base equal.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
Great. Well, thanks,
Thank
Jeff.
You.
Thanks for your call. Mark, as Jeff was mentioning, the decline in the sport of golf across the country, what happens to some of these courses when they're not being used and sites shut down? Are there any trends that we should be paying attention to in case there are more Shadow Pines happening across the country?
I haven't run across a lot of that. I am aware that the declining play of golf is declining and has been for some time. I haven't seen sort of repurpose. I like the idea of communities converting it to open space. And to the degree that they have the abilities, that's terrific, because I think it'll be better off as a land use. I don't have a tremendous amount of experience with seeing those conversions.
We put a call out on Twitter to see what community members thought about green space. And some of the feedback that came in was about parking. And this is Dennis in Rochester. He says, less surface parking lots would be helpful. And Bill, before the hour, you were talking about the generational differences in opinions when it comes to parking.
Yeah, we've done our share of parking studies, mobility studies, and it does appear that when we do our public engagement process, that we find a distinct difference between the perception for the need for parking from the boomer generation on versus what the millennial generation feels about the need for parking. And the perception of whether you pay for the parking or you don't pay for parking. But generally speaking, I think, you know, in most cases in this country, there is enough asphalt. Certainly, currently, there's enough to support, you know, the parking for commercial uses, whether you're in a specific area or you're along a commercial corridor. I think what has to, you know, some of the problems come in when it's privately owned. And, you know, the owners don't share it, you know, nighttime uses, you know, the kind of these off-peak uses could share parking. We don't see that happening. It's whether it's maintenance and operations or insurance and liability reasons, we don't see it happening. That's really the next step is, you know, formation of districts or some mechanism to allow for shared parking so that we're not taking buildings down and putting down asphalt.
Mark, I see you nodding.
Yeah, I think there's much smarter ways to manage parking than to continue to tear down buildings and make surface parking lots. And the technology's there, and it's very, you know, immediate. And I'm a fan of less parking. I don't want to build cities for cars. We want to build cities for people.
You're helping me transition, because I was just sitting here thinking, your colleague Bill, Howard Decker, is the strongest proponent I know of a carless future. Do you agree with him? Do you think we're heading toward a completely carless future?
I think the carless future is probably not going to be in my lifetime. But I think that it's probably, you know, car ownership is going to change. The different options for access to vehicles is going to change. I think you'll see certainly, you know, the Lyfts and the Ubers, although I don't see autonomous vehicles dominating the streetscape in the near future, but I do see, you know, people maybe reducing the number of cars that they buy and relying more on some of these services, which, you know, using those services, they don't take up parking spaces. Those cars are continually moving. So I see the dynamic certainly changing. I think Howard is correct in that, you know, that is going to happen, but I don't think it's going to be in our lifetime.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Mark?
I'm not sure. I hope I live long enough to see it. Not sure I will, but I hope I do. I do think that the emphasis on the automobile, the lobby, the automobile industry is a strong proponent out there. And you know, I have two millennials, and neither of them got their driver's license until they were 20 years old. When I was a kid, 16 and a half, I had my driver's license. And you know, they just didn't place that emphasis on transportation. They walked, they took transit. We live on a transit line, so they took transit into Cambridge and Boston, and they just didn't find a need. And I think we're seeing more and more of that, where there's less and less interest in driving, like home ownership. I mean, in terms of a generational shift, that there's less emphasis on having to do that. I think that's great, because I think that changes, it really does change the paradigm. And, you know, emissions from automobiles and planes are not good for the climate. And so I think to the degree we less dependent on automobiles, great. And that's not to say there isn't going to be dependency on automobiles. There ultimately will be, because not everybody lives in an urban center where they don't need one. So I think you just have to find whatever that, strike that balance. But I'm a proponent of less cars and less pollution.
I was part of the charrette process in Shalott recently, where we were discussing ideas for how to rebuild the Port of Rochester, how to transform it. And one of the conversations that was had over and over again throughout the process was about bringing a trolley back to Shalott. And the idea was to have it run from the beach up through Lake Avenue, up here to the city, to connect the city and the beach. And I'm wondering, Bill, if you think there's any hope for something like that, because there are many people in this community who would like to see it. It's nostalgic. It would reduce the number of cars and parking lots down at the beach area. But then there are others who say, you know, that's too idealistic. We'll never be back to the trolley days when it comes to that part of town.
Well, I would certainly be all for it. I think, you know, one of the things to do with Lake Avenue and the connection to the port, between the city and the port, is to first make sure that Lake Avenue is built to kind of these new complete street standards, so that until the trolley can happen, we could possibly have a dedicated bus lane. Kind of go in incremental steps. I think, you know, to find the money to build that, we have to be put a little bit of reality to that. But certainly the concept of moving people through by public transit between the city and, you know, one of our greatest assets, which is the port and the lake, we can have the bike lanes, we can have dedicated bus lanes, and then hopefully we can dedicate one of those lanes to a trolley system.
I know there are studies out there about how effective or ineffective trolley systems or streetcars and things like that can be. Mark, in your experience, when you're designing around options that may already exist, or you have the opportunity to create spaces for that, in which direction would you push people? Or is it a case-by-case basis, probably?
It is more case-by-case, but if I had my preference, I'd say fixed rail is the way to go. Streetcars are very successful in many cities, and I think that would be, and that also dictates or certainly encourages where development happens, where interesting mixed-use development. You have intermodal transit accessible, and you see corridors develop. I lived in Dallas in the 90s, and Dallas was the ultimate automobile car. I grew up in Boston, and we didn't have many cars, but Dallas was automobiles. And they did a rapid transit line up the I-75 corridor north, first transit line in Dallas. And it exceeded all rider expectation. And 5 years after it was done, you saw incredible development happening at important stops at Mockingbird Lane, up at Walnut. It amazing transition to what that means to city building. And then you have ridership, which is important. And you just, it transformed, you know, sort of a mentality of an automobile city, I think.
We're down to our last minute with Mark Dawson and Bill Price. Bill, remind us about the event tonight and where people can learn more.
Tonight, Mark is speaking on urban and open space issues at the Gleason Works at 7 o'clock tonight. Runs for about an hour and a half, Mark, and we look forward to it.
And that is a free event, listeners, so make sure you get there early. My thanks to Mark Dawson, Managing Principal and Landscape Architect for Sasaki Associates. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Bill Price, a Landscape Architect and Urban Planner with SWBR, and also with the Community Design Center. My thanks to you.
Thank you, Megan.
Stay with us, listeners. More Connections next. We're talking about the connection between art and politics and how certain pieces of art can help us better understand our world. More Connections next.